You're listening to Venture in the South, a podcast searching for innovation in the Southern U.S. Join us to make money, have fun, and do good. Welcome back to Venture in the South. We're doing a special episode this week about a new legislative effort known as HB 2799. That's House Bill 2799 in the Congress of the United States, that directly impacts on angel investing and is of interest to every startup investor and venture capitalist too, for that matter. And so Paul knows a lot about this. So I'm going to be interviewing Paul about this, and we're going to be discussing this a little bit because I think it's particularly relevant to our listeners who are investors in startups. So Paul, tell us, what is HB 2799?
Thanks, David. Good to be back on the show. So HB 2799 is a bill that went through the House of Representatives last Friday that is an interesting potential piece of legislation that covers a number of different subjects. They were actually sort of rolling together a number of different legislative efforts from the past. I think it originally started in this form in about April of 2023. So people have been thinking about some of these issues for a while, and finally a bill has passed the first part of Congress to potentially make some changes to how we think about a number of topics in the early stage investing arena.
Well, this is particularly relevant in the context of the SEC trying, or at least considering, making changes in the definition of an accredited investor. And so this might impact on that and maybe rein in some of the various aspects of the SEC tightening that definition in an unfavorable way. So why are we talking about this today?
Well, we're talking about it today because it passed the House last Friday. Normally, we steer away from politics generally. And usually, we stay away from sort of proposed legislation too, because it often never gets to the finish line, and potentially it's not ever quite as important as you might think. But in this case, I think it is potentially a pretty game-changing piece of legislation. And so I wanted to at least explore the issues, and we can talk at the end about whether or not this will ever actually come to fruition. But I think it's interesting to explore some of the issues that are being discussed and some of the pros and cons of the proposed changes. We've covered some of these issues in the past on the podcast, you know, the definition of accredited investor, some rules around securities offering and how you register and what kind of rules you have to follow, and some of the things about venture capital fund rules as well, which is also impacted by this potential legislation. And actually, there's a bunch of other stuff in here, which is interesting, but less close to our day jobs, but some interesting stuff around crowdfunding rules and risk disclosures and broker rules and all kinds of other stuff too.
So let's dive into that. So what are the key aspects of the legislation that would affect startup investors?
Yeah, so there's probably three key ones. The first one is defining what an accredited investor is. And you'll probably remember from other shows and from other content we've used that accredited investors is defined at the moment as somebody with $200,000 of income, or $300,000 if you're married filing jointly, or a net worth excluding the equity in your house of $1 million, or a couple of other ways that you can now be accredited if you have a professional advisory license, a Series 7, 65, or 82 license. So there's a couple of ways that you can be an accredited investor at the moment. And there's a lot of discussion about whether that strikes the right balance between allowing people the freedom to invest in whatever they want versus protecting people who can't afford to lose money in some situations. The SEC's definition is the one that I mentioned then. There is definitely a lot of effort to try to make that definition more relaxed so that more people can make these early stages investments. There's also pressure to make it tighter, to perhaps index that threshold back to inflation, which would index that to inflation back to the 1980s in some proposals, would increase those thresholds, make it much harder to be accredited and make these investments. So there's a lot of debate about that.
That's what the SEC is considering now, right? Is tightening the definition, make it available to fewer people.
There are some people in the SEC that want to do that, yeah. There are others on the committee that looks at this that don't, and lots of people sort of lobbying from both directions, yeah. They changed the definition, I think probably 10 years ago, to remove the equity in your home. So that made it harder to be accredited. And so, you know, they have fiddled around with this, but then they brought in the professional licensing ability to be accredited through that, I think probably a few years ago too. So there's constant sort of rebalancing of what this is. the interesting thing about this legislation or potential legislation here is that Congress wants to change that to make it much easier to be accredited. And so they've come up with two ways to do that. One is to amend the definition of accredited investor to any investor, regardless of, you know, how much money you have, as long as your investment isn't more than 10% of your income or worth, net worth. So that basically opens it up to anybody to make early stage investing, as long as you're not making big bets relative to your income or wealth. And so that potentially increases the number of angel investments that people can do. You know, the number of accredited households would go from 15 million, something like that, to everybody, which would be, you know, obviously a pretty significant change of approach.
Yeah, that seems like it makes a lot of sense because it's making the investable assets relative. That is, if you have a small amount of investable assets, you can still invest. You just are limited to how much you can invest, whereas a fixed definition is kind of arbitrary.
It is, yeah. I don't know if 10% of your income is the right answer. And I'm sure there's a lot of haggling about the details of what that really means and who decides and how do you prove it and all of that. But I mean, the philosophy of letting people invest something in early stage companies doesn't seem unreasonable to me. So that's the proposal at the moment. The question, I guess, for you to flip that back is, do you think it will actually make any difference to how much people invest and how much is invested in early stage companies or not?
That is the critical question in terms of the ecosystem, because there's a couple of things that are impacted by this. One is the amount of funding available for startups, which, of course, we've had a couple of really tough years where funding has decreased in 22 and in 23. And so more founders are scrapping for less money. And it doesn't really make sense because the quality of founding companies has not declined. There's actually more of the same quality. And so you're having potentially viable businesses not being founded because they just can't be funded. Or you have viable businesses that can't get funding and have to close because they haven't grown enough to satisfy, you know, the top tier investors. On the flip side, the investors want to invest money, but I think a rational investor doesn't want to put all of their investable assets into one category. You don't want to put a huge chunk of your investable assets in startup investments because it's a risky category. You want to diversify. And so for the average investor that's under the age of 55, it might make sense to have 10 or 15% of your investable capital invested in startups. But if you're over 55, that's probably a smaller number. And if you're over 70, rationally, it's probably zero unless it's a hobby. Because the timeline is 10 years rationally. And so you kind of have to think about this in terms of age and career. And I think that changing the definition makes a lot of sense because right now the rigid definition is skewed towards older end of career investors, which is not the right group for startup investing. They really should be younger because of that 10-year timeline. And you might want to have that 10-year timeline two or three times. So you need to start when you're 25 and recycle that capital again when you're 35 and then again when you're 45. And so that gives an opportunity for someone young to invest a little bit of money, get great returns, you know, an IRR of in the range of greater than 20%, which can make a huge difference in terms of their retirement savings later on when they cash out. And so I think the definition has a tremendous impact, not just on the founders, but on the investors, if they can loosen it up in a rational way.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point about the age overlap here, about how helpful it will be to people early in their careers or with less assets now, but expecting to have more assets later, can deploy some of them now into this asset class. I think that's a good point. The other definition change that they're thinking about is, or that's proposed in this bill, is to say that if you're getting advice from a licensed professional, so somebody that has one of those series licenses that I mentioned, then you're also accredited up to any amount. So you could be borderline accredited under the current definition, but if you're getting advice from somebody with a professional license, you are definitely accredited, which again, probably on the margin has an impact. Maybe it's not quite such a big change as the first one, but potentially could have a bit of an impact as well.
Yeah, I could see how that would have a significant impact in a different way, because now you have professional advisors who are all about diversification and lowering risk. They're going to be selecting deal flow for their clients. And that's, of course, what this business is all about, is deal flow. You know, do you have good deal flow? Do you get to pick and choose the best deals? And so it's going to put the purveyors of deal flow on the stage, and they're going to have to perform for these investor advisors and show why they are a good source of deal flow for these investment advisors.
Yeah, that's a good point. Most, I think, sort of wealth advisors don't spend a ton of time thinking about early stage investing on behalf of their clients or putting deals in front of them. They sometimes respond to demand from their clients to look at a given deal or something, but they aren't necessarily proactively working at this asset class. And this may prompt more to do that.
I don't think they're going to have the bandwidth to do individual deals. I think what they're going to do if this goes through is they're going to select providers of deal flow, or select funds or organizations that do early stage deals, and they're going to go with them. That's what I think is likely to happen.
You could be right. Yeah. One of the things about changing this definition means there's going to be more opportunities to deploy smaller checks from people. 10% of your net income, if you're earning $100,000 a year, is a $10,000 check in one deal, which is kind of a lot. So you diversify that. So let's say we're looking at checks in the $500 to $1,000 range. That historically has not been very easy to deploy in sort of traditional early stage investing. And so it wouldn't surprise me if there's more people trying to write those checks. So there might be more investment firms or funds or groups like Venture South that will try to find more ways to accommodate those smaller checks in a cost efficient and, you know, brain not destroying way. I think that might be an interesting catalyst to some new ways to deploy capital too.
Definitely attractive. But the devil's in the details, because right now you have a fairly robust crowdfunding regulatory system, but it's expensive and burdensome for the provider of deal flow. And so the costs are high for the investor, you know, the much higher for a crowdfunding investor than for an angel investor. And so hopefully if they make these kinds of changes where they kind of lump everyone together, and make it a percentage of income, that they're going to also provide some regulatory relief. And so it's less costly to provide these small check investments. So small investors can get involved at a young age and not be paying 20, 30% in fees.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Then you asked me what the key changes were. So another area of potential changes, this one's perhaps a little bit smaller, is some of the rules around how you register a fundraise. At the moment, if you try to sell securities in your company, you have to register with the SEC unless you have an exemption to that registration. But there's no exemption at the moment for size. Any fundraising of any size has to go through that process, which is why when you raise friends and family money, technically you're raising money, you're selling securities in your company, you're registered by the SEC, you should fill in the right forms to get through that process. And a lot of people don't, because they either don't know about it or they don't care and they think they'll get away with it. And so a lot of people don't comply and technically speaking, do unregistered securities offerings, which is a bad thing to be doing. So this legislation actually puts in a new exemption that says, if you're raising less than $250,000, you don't have to do that. You're automatically exempt from those rules. So you don't have to fill in the forms. You are a micro offering, and you don't have to worry about that fundraising regime anymore, which is an interesting addition.
Yeah, that's an intelligent deregulation.
I think I'd probably agree with that. Yeah, I think there are some valid concerns that those small offerings can often be done non-compliantly and fraudulently. So perhaps there's an argument that when you get a lot of sophisticated investors looking at something, obviously it's not foolproof, but if you get a lot of sophisticated investors looking at a bigger thing, then it's less likely to be fraudulent or misleading than, you know, a couple of guys doing a small amount with a small, you know, a small fundraising. So it could be an argument against doing that. But on the other hand, I think overall what happens here is this just makes a lot of people less non-compliant, because they're doing these fundraisings anyway. They're not filling in the forms. Technically, they're getting themselves in potential trouble which really doesn't make any difference in the grand scheme of things. So just making this one less burden perhaps helps a little bit on compliance overall.
Rolling South is a startup fund focused on the southern United States. We welcome founders, operators, and investors seeking innovation, diligence, and community. Join us to make money while having fun and doing good. Contact Rolling South to learn more.
So tell us about your view of the impact of these sorts of changes on VC and larger investing.
Well, that one specifically, I don't think will make much difference to larger rounds, although it will give us a bit more reassurance when we're investing later that the companies hasn't done something in the past that makes it, you know, dangerous to invest in this company. But there are some things in the bill that directly impact larger funds. There's actually some things around venture capital fundraising structures and rules that are pretty intriguing. One of those is this legislation would expand the definition of what a qualifying venture capital fund is. And I won't go into all the regulatory world about this, but essentially there's a couple of rules at the moment that say, if you want to raise a venture capital fund, you have to decide whether you can raise from 99 investors, in which case you can raise as much money as you want, or from 249 or 250 investors, in which case you can't raise more than $10 million in your fund, which is an interesting sort of dynamic. It means that smaller early stage venture capital funds can't raise small checks very easily from lots of small investors. They have to find a smaller number, a bigger check, which is not an easy thing to do if you're starting out in the venture capital space. And so there's a bit of complaint around that 99 or 249 investor rules limit that's currently in place. This legislation would change that and change it to 600 investors and 150 million. Those would be the two things to think about.
That's a big change.
It's a big change. Yeah, it would make it a lot easier to take a lot of small checks for an emerging fund manager and make, you know, fundraising for VCs quite a lot easier, especially at that early stage, front end, smaller funds, emerging manager kind of market. It would make angel-list syndicates much bigger, or potentially much bigger, much easier to, you know, allow people into. It would make my life at Venture South a lot easier because we're limited by those things too on some of the SPVs that we use. And, you know, I have to make sure that we have the right money in the right SPVs so we don't break any of those limits. And it's kind of a pain to keep track of all that. Whereas I could now put all this in one big LLC, one big SPV. So it would make some entities like Venture South a great deal easier to administer and therefore cheaper to administer. And we could pass those cost savings back on to investors to make it cheaper for them to invest. So pretty interesting potential change that could make it a lot easier and a lot cheaper to invest in early stage venture funds.
Yeah, I could see a big effect there because of this reason. So right now, funds kind of, at least in my view, involve two general categories. You have smaller funds that basically survive off of the carry, so the profits that they generate for their investors. Because they're a small fund, the fees don't add up to enough to support the fund. And then larger funds where they mainly survive on the fees and the carry is not as big a deal for them as the fees are. So they're going for very big funds that they get 2% off of. And so if you have a change like this where you're saying you're going to lower the costs and the regulatory burden to these smaller funds, I think that's probably good for small funds and for investors because investors are going to pay less fees and they're going to be more oriented towards capital gains.
Yeah, you could be right. I think it is likely that this makes it a lot easier for people to invest in formal venture capital funds that are small. I think that's probably the biggest impact. Instead of having to write a $250,000 check into, you know, a decent regional VC fund, you can now plausibly write a $25,000 check into that because the funds don't really have a limit on how many investors they can have in them, practically speaking. So I think that is probably the biggest change is making those funds more viable and making it easier for people to dip their toes into more formal venture capital funds, as well as further downstream, making it easier to be an angel group and making it easier to invest a small check in a syndicate, you know, on AngelList. All of that becomes a bit easier when these rules are slightly looser.
Yeah.
There's another sort of related thing in there about venture capital funds, where the definition of a, or the exemption for being a private fund manager increases. So this is getting a bit arcane, but they're moving that threshold from 150 million to over 200 million. They're indexing that back to inflation to 2010, which might lessen the regulatory burden a bit for funds in that sort of 150 to 200 million dollar size range too, which probably is helpful. There's arguments about whether you should index everything for inflation on these kinds of things or not, but the goal here is to make more fund managers exempt from having to register with the SEC.
So explain how a private fund is different than a venture capital fund.
Oh boy. So you're going to need a securities attorney to go through all the different legislations and definitions of these things. Basically, it's the same thing, but in different acts and different regulatory regimes, they mean slightly different things about who gets regulated and who doesn't. It dictates which kind of regulatory regime you fall into. So I don't want to talk about that, and our listeners do not want to hear about that. But if you really do want to learn about that, yeah, there's some good blog posts and things that help outline that.
Okay. And then what else can you say about this legislation?
Well, so there's a bunch of other stuff in the bill, which is interesting. It's one of these ones where they've just thrown everything together and passed it. So there's a bunch of stuff, some of which is tangentially related to early stage investing. So they're making some changes to what brokers have to do. They're making some changes to some of the Reg A plus crowdfunding rules, which I don't know so much about as the angel space. So I'll let the listeners go read the bill if they want to learn about some of that. There's some things around simplifying how your risks are disclosed in investment funds, which probably, again, is a good thing, because if you read the PPMs of a venture capital fund, they go on for pages about all the different risks that could impact this investment, and nobody reads them because they're too long. So some kind of simplified risk disclosure makes, I think, some sense, and there's some rules in the legislation about that. You know, generally speaking, they seem to be making people's lives easier, so without further diving into them, probably, you know, inclined to say that they're a good idea, but there's obviously some concerns about some of them as well. And then there's just some other stuff, some completely unrelated stuff in there, which actually is a potential problem, because you could maybe object to those things more, but you've got the whole thing to think about here. So one of those other things is rules around definition of workers, classifying gig workers as employees or not, which is a hot button topic.
Oh my goodness.
As well, but totally unrelated to this other stuff, but it's in there. And so there's some other stuff to think about more widely when you look at the bill itself.
Yeah, that definitely is something that is a lightning rod for problems. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the main things that the Biden administration came out and said, look, we're not going to support this law. And their first reason is because of the worker classification stuff that's in it. So, you know, whether you think gig workers should be compensated as a W-2 employee, or, you know, maintain the flexibility to be a gig worker, which is what they signed up for, or not, that now is determining whether accredited investor definition should change. It's kind of, it's the way the legislative sausage gets made, but it's a kind of a mess.
Well, that gets to the next step, which is the Senate. So that's an opportunity to change some of these things, to negotiate a revised bill. And so what does that look like? It going to the Senate and the chance of it becoming law?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the person to ask on this. There's various betting websites you can look at that give it a somewhere around a 33% chance of passing, which, you know, isn't bad. We looked at some legislation last year that had a 4% chance on the same thing. So, you know, people think this is probably more likely than the last attempt at it, but still not, you know, not likely, especially during an election year when the administration said they really don't favor it. I think your guess is as good as mine. It's probably not a great chance of all this passing, but at least it puts these issues on the table and makes a clear proposal. So people can argue the merits of either side as they want to and keep it on the agenda.
Yeah, I look at this as a evolution, so that this version, this bill probably will not pass, but it will become the foundation for future legislative efforts in this same direction that after the election would have a better chance of passing, regardless of these small rules that politically are being inserted here about employment, gig working, and things like that, that are problematic, but maybe grease the wheels in some way And so if they add that on or they subtract that, that will work better after the election than before. And so my own prediction is low probability of passing, but becomes a foundation for a new legislative effort in the next 4 years.
You could be right. Yeah. I also think it sort of airs these issues a bit and makes it clear to the SEC that, you know, there's a pretty good number of people that don't want to tighten the rules on accredited investors, for example. And so if they now turn around when they do their review and tighten them, then at least they're aware that there's going to be some legislative fallout from that potentially. So I think it's, you know, useful to keep these things in people's minds because they do make an impact. So you might say, well, this is all very interesting, but none of this actually makes a difference in the end. There's quite a lot of good studies out there that say even minor changes to some of these rules has a pretty dramatic impact on the availability of capital. That one I mentioned at the beginning where they changed and took out your equity in your house as part of the definition. That was a really cool study that showed that really did have a pretty significant impact, especially in markets like ours, where there isn't a ton of early stage capital funding already. I'll put a link to that paper in the show notes because it's pretty cool. But it had a much bigger impact than you would think on funding and all the downstream stuff that comes from that, patent filings and follow-on fundings and exits and all of that. So this stuff does actually make a decent difference in practice. And so just to have it on the legislative agenda, I think is a good thing to keep people thinking about it.
You're right about that. It's potentially a significant impact on basically the freedom to invest and the freedom to profit from the innovation that goes on in our country. And why should we restrict that to the wealthy citizens and not give everybody a shot at that? It just flies in the face of what America is all about. So I think definitely they're on the right track here, and we're likely to see some change, just not this cycle.
I will take that bet. I'll offer you some good odds on that, and we'll reconvene in a couple of years to see whether you were right.
All right. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, listeners.
Thank you for listening. Visit us at ventureinthesouth.com for a complete list of previous and future shows.